Mr. Whittaker, Reel 9. How did you get the news of the trip to Tobruk? Because it was a bit of a rush job, wasn't it?
Yes. We must have been down on the canal. We had some sort of camp, I believe, on the canal for this invasion training. I can't remember why. We didn't do anything on the boats. But I know all of a sudden everybody was ordered back to help. There was a really wild, absolute chaos. All the invasion thing was off, everything was done. Brand new, lots of new kit. New men, personnel, new trucks. And I know there was some talk amongst the drivers that regiments had been ordered to give us everything we wanted. But they were ordered not to do the usual thing and give us everything they didn't want, which of course was the usual thing when they got rid of things. So everything had to be A1. Frantic, when I was wireless sets, batteries, we were getting them charged, spares, making sure the telephones, everything had to be. It was a real frantic. Can't really remember. I know they gave us a couple of days or something to get ready and go, which we duly did. We were still sorting things out, as far as I remember, as we moved. And I do remember I was put on, for the first time, I was put on X-CAR, which was the battery commander for Major Peter Birkin. That was on the wireless set. We had these little, I think they were 800 weights, we call them PUs, thing which has come into fashion again lately. It had a little canvas-covered truck with the wireless set on one side and a bench on the other. Usually just had one signal in the back, the driver and the officer.
Which would be Peter Birkin.
That was Peter Birkin.
And who was your driver at that time?
Can't remember. Excuse me. But I know I was put on, simply put on there. And we moved.
Did you have to fit the wireless, or was it?
It was already in, but as I say, we made sure we had to have spare batteries, make sure it was working, everything was tested. Then we moved out with. I can't remember whether we actually did any listening or whether we used the set. We probably. We used to have a thing sometimes, a sort of listening thing, where we tuned every half hour or something and just checked that it was going. And the first day took us, or half day, took us to Cairo, and where we made camp just in the, almost in the shadow of the pyramids, which was quite interesting. We'd been there before, but we actually camped quite close to the pyramids, and we were told we could go into Cairo, or there was a camp somewhere nearby, Mina. And any trouble was, we'd not been paid. But my recollection of that, one of my friends, Dennis Middleton, he a good organiser, quite a sophisticated sort of chap compared to myself. I know we pooled resources, and he led the party, and a bunch of us, and we, I know we went and had either a shave, a haircut or something, which was one of the, and then we went on and had what could only be described as a riotous night out. I can remember Dennis, who I, it was at least, I think he was a Lance Bombardier or Lance Sergeant in the signals. And I can remember him being gently but firmly removed from the stage of the cabaret, where he was attempting to accompany one of the belly dancers. I can also remember him, they had candles in candlesticks, but Dennis insist on putting these in a bottle and proclaiming it some sort of tribute to our predecessor in World War I, who would have, you know, on the eve of battle. He was quite a lad. Getting home was a bit of a problem. I'm afraid several of us finished up on our hands and knees crawling through the flower bed. Some of us, and I think I was one, are halfway stopped the taxi and were heartily sick on the side of the road. And the driver then, it wasn't a taxi at all, he was an Egyptian on the make. But it was most alarming in case we were sick. But anyway, we got back to camp. Don't know how late it was, but another thing I can remember was Peter Birkin walking up and down through the camp, making sure everybody was safely in. And I can remember him telling me that I should be on that so-and-so truck in the morning, even if it killed me. And he was telling everybody, you know, it was first flight and you're out there. And in the morning, I remember getting into the truck and the major saying to me, "Have you got a headache?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Serve you bloody well right." And that was all the sympathy, it was all we deserved. So we set off and went up to a camp outside Alexandria, a name I've forgotten. But I know the we went to Anafi, where it was a much more sober, no one spent up anyway, pretty well. But I understand, I know the sergeants got it, there was a riotous episode there, which I understand they were lucky to get away with.
What did they do? What were the rumours?
I don't know if they wrecked the mess or simply threw beer and stuff at one another. I wasn't privileged then to join them in these. But I know there was some sort of, you know, there was a lot of talk about it. In the next few days, from then on, going up there, then we did. We had the wireless on all the time, and there were various checks and orders, nothing particular, you know, just keep going. And gradually, by the time we got to, we did have a stop on the way when we went to bathe, I remember, in the middle of the, quite late at night. It was pretty cold, but still, you know, it was very dusty travelling.
What was the convoy routine like? I mean, how did the... You organised the regiment on the road, or not you, but how was the regiment organised?
As far as I can remember, the colonel, an advance party had gone up first, and we moved by RHQ, then the batteries. In extra, we moved at the head of the column, and the guns followed. You know, there was an orderly routine with signal trucks, you know, for the various... you know, the battery commander, and we were in touch with all of them through the truck. Only trouble was with the PU, you've got to lean out to shout. There was no, which I could order, there was canvas flaps in the back, which you had to sort of bang on the top. The officer usually stand up in the front, you didn't sit down, it just wasn't, you know, stood up and held the bars, it looked important, and you'd bang on the things and then shout. But by the time we got to the bottom of the escarpment saloon, Hellfire Pass, which of course was Hellfire Pass, it was beginning to get, there it began to really get chaotic. I can remember it was...
In what way?
Well, it was get up there and get on as fast as you can. Filling up to the brims with petrol, spare cans in the back. There was lots of traffic coming. This was a real, what you call a mountain pass, you know, a zigzag track up this very steep hill. And that was the border with Libya. As I say, now I can remember it being absolutely frantic with everybody filled up and checking out and on the way. I think we travelled then through the night.
Now, you've got a note in your history that you blew up your radio set at this point. What was that?
First, this was one of the things I'm not very proud of. I wasn't always the most efficient soldier. And on the way up to Tobruk, which I didn't know, incidentally, I've never heard, it was just, I had heard the name, but it didn't mean a thing to me. It was pitch dark, the traffic was enormous, everybody was nose to tail then, the convoy thing of, 50 yards or whatever, the order had gone close up, there could be no light whatsoever, you're nose to tail, and I was told to listen out for orders from some, probably the Colonel Seeley, who I found later and was in the health college. I know we'd tuned to a special frequency. On the way, traffic coming the other way, and every now and then they'd stop, and we got such things as, good luck, mate, you'll bloody need it. People were pouring, you could hear traffic out in the desert as well, we were on the road. And the set started to go faint. All I did was listen. There was no checking at all. It was, they didn't say what I was silence, as they would say now later. But they just said, listen out. And everything began to get faint. I changed the batteries. This was pitch dark. And all I got from them on was static, which I didn't. I thought, oh, well, it's all I'd had most of the time. In the morning when I checked it, I'd fused the thing. I'd connected the... Because I'd changed in the dark, I hadn't changed to what we call occasionally an accumulator, which is like a car battery. They're all batteries later on, but occasionally we did call them this old-fashioned term. In the dark, which was the recognised thing, I hadn't swapped over to those spares. We had a big dry battery, and I plugged the wrong things in, fused it. So no wonder all I got was static. Forget just what I did, but I know Sergeant Gore, we changed, I confessed to him, I didn't to the Major, first light, as soon as I checked it and found, we swapped the set. As I say, I got away with apart from being called all the so-so idiots or the stuff, which was, I must admit, it was I should have known better, but in the dark you can't tell red from black. But they were a slightly different shape, as I remember, so you could.
And that was round about the time you were going up the escarpment to the Libyan...
This was the last night before we actually... as far as I remember, we might have actually just been in Tobruk that must have been the morning. As I say, I had this catastrophe on the actual way. Fortunately, there hadn't been any messages. And so we got into this place, didn't even know where it was for the first day. The first 2 or 3 days there were absolute chaos.
Now, who you say you mentioned you were with X car, but you also mentioned X troop. That's a new
A troop. There was A troop, B troop, but the cars all had a number. Ours, X was the battery commander. I think A B was A troop commander, and so on.
But now you were with battery headquarters.
I was with the battery commander as his radio operator.
Now, what do you remember about it? I mean, the first 3 days was an awful lot of action. What do you remember about what happened to you in that time?
All I did, this truck was dashing here and there, all over the place. I heard we passed various orders to and listen to orders from our OP people. I think it was Captain Slim B troop, Captain Pringle on A troop. I never knew where they were. I don't think I saw out the back of the truck. Heard the guns firing a time or two. It was quite chaotic as far as I was concerned.
So you wouldn't know really what was happening from your position?
No, we knew there were these calls to drop into action and fire a few, you know, and people reported tanks, infantry coming in from west, east, or wherever. But Major Birkin, he was dashing about, and from where I sat, all it was messages on a wireless set. And we did find out there were Australians in, and we did find out to say it was this place called Tobruk. The only amusing thing was they were running out of ammunition. The gunners reported they were short of ammunition. And the Major told an officer called John Newman, who we regarded as quite frankly, a bit of a wimp, really. He was, I think he was a transport officer, something like that. But I know he put him in our truck and told him to go and get ammunition, told him where it was. And he took the battery commander's truck with me in it because we'd got communication, so he could keep in touch. We got to this ammunition dump, and I've since read books, and of course everybody tells this story, but perfectly true. There was a sergeant on the gate who refused to let him in and said, "I must have authority." And to everybody's delight, we're all right close up, ammunition, and we've got the 30-100 weights, and he's ready to take ammunition. And when he sort of questioned there, "Where's your authority?" to our delight, Mr. Newman replied, my authority is coming out of that bloody hill in Mark 3s and 4s, which Mark being the German tanks. And this chap let him in, and we simply went and loaded up. When we left, he was still there. I know he gave him his name and the regiment, but he was still, this chap in charge was still bemoaning the fact he hadn't got the paperwork and that we didn't know how much we'd taken. But that was about the only vivid recollection of that first few days, except the guns had actually fired.
Did you know, for instance, there was nearly a breakthrough of German tanks at one point? Would you know anything about that?
All we knew, we heard this fight, and there were reports of these tanks. And when we collected this ammunition, there were actually sounds of battle, machinery, and things quite close to us. I haven't a clue whereabouts into what that was.
What was the role of your truck? There's messages. Was Birkin acting as just as battery commander?
Battery commander. He was being told where to go, and he was making sure his troops, the two troops under him, were, that the message were passed to his troop commanders and so on. And he reported back if we got requests from regimental headquarters. He reported back where we were as far as we knew what we were doing.
So in a sense, it was almost like a roving commission, because he wasn't acting as a gun position commander, officer, and he wasn't acting as an OP.
No, he was roving. He was simply roving around, keeping everybody, making sure everything, as I say, that the guns had got the ammunition and that we were doing whatever we were asked to do.
And this period went on for about how long, do you reckon?
2-3 days.
I mean, did the rations come up?
They must have done, but I don't think we had much time to. I think it was a case of grabbing usual thing, 5 minutes, hop out and brew up.
And did anyone help the driver driving, or would he be driving all the time on his own?
As far as I know, he was driving all the time.
So he'd driven all the way up?
Driven all the way up. And I remember the only time I can remember sort of seeing other people occasionally was seeing the signal sergeant when we renewed batteries and made sure everything was okay.
Now, how would you brew up? I mean, was there a special quick method you had at the time?
Usually, a tin full of sand, pour petrol on it, and stick the whatever billy can you had on top and light it. Made a very good fire, petrol, but the sand sort of kept it, instead of flaring up, it kept it lit and grew up quite quickly. I know once or twice we were having to sort of dump it in the back of the, you know, take the fire out and pour the tea out, and then we'll have to drink as we went. We got caught a time or two.
Were you under fire much yourself? I mean,
No, I didn't. Heard some shelling, but didn't, and saw in the distance a lot of smoke and some of the shell bursts, but never came under anything at all.
And what about any sign of Stukas or? Because
didn't see any of those first 3 days.
Now, is there anything else you remember about the first 3 days? It's obviously very chaotic and.
No, it was so hazy, we dashed about, as I say, so much, that the first real signs of settling down and knowing where we finished up at a place near a park called Palestrino. There came into contact with the senior, we were soon notified, was the senior regiment in the British Army, the 1st Royal Horse Artillery, where we actually were told, or ordered, and we dropped in troop by troop. 1st RHA 425, 1st RHA 425, which we were told were all under one. I think we're under the command of 1st RHA, I'm not certain, but certainly we were in very close liaison. I can remember them quite well because I had exotic, there was one troop there we told was a really faint rocket troop. What impressed me, they had shiny, trail handles on the guns, they'd still got them polished, and they had one polished spade and a polished pickaxe, which they didn't use, still put on the gun. On the trails. These were real soldiers. But anyway, we were, as I say, we were four guns of theirs, four guns of ours.
And what were your impressions? I mean, they were regulars, the sort of cream of the regular army artillery, and you were territorials. Did you look up to them, or what did you think of them?
Just another regiment of artillery. We were aware. I know Major Birkin told, I can remember him telling us that these were, as I say, this was where I first heard the term, the light of the line used to. But as I say, we finished up this, I always remember because it was Easter, and I don't know whether that was about Good Friday or about that time. Because the real action started Easter Sunday night, and Easter Monday was the day I remember particularly well. There'd been quite a lot of firing. I was actually then, I think I was off the truck. And certainly when the big action started, I was on A Troop's gun position.
And what were you doing there?
If I say nothing, I was standing by to make sure telephone lines were kept in good order. But we were quite close to the sitting round the chap who was actually on the telephone at the gun position.
And had you been able to dig A Troop in at all?
They were dug in, they'd all dug. Gun pits, just rough round, enough to get the guns down. Some of it was very hard because some of it was rocky.
Would they have sandbagged walls?
They put some sandbag walls. and we'd all dug. We were in slip trenches. As I say, first thing in the morning, it was an absolute. Then there was a real battle going on. And it was at that time, quite early in the day, probably very early in the morning, that we got this famous thing, which everybody in the in 425 remembers, where Captain Bennett, this was the Bennett incident, who had been the chaplain of the Bridges and Spurs when I first joined up, been commissioned in the field, and we lost communication for a bit. He was in a place, the wire extended in a rough semicircle around Tobruk, and there were concrete posts every now and then. Once they dug in, concrete dug out, he got up to one of those with a bunch of Australian infantry. And he'd, as I say, he'd seen during the night, there could, I believe, it was probably moonlight, but there was lots of activity. And he gave this famous order, which, here I think I'm in disagreement with the regimental history, because I distinctly remember that this order came down, which was repeated by this chaplain, fire on me in 5 minutes, or something like, target me, fire on me in 5 minutes, but he definitely gave a delay. And his idea, we learned later, the Germans had filled in they were filling in the anti-tank trench, and his idea that the tanks had already crossed, but they hadn't cooperated ever so well, and of course, so our specialist there, busy working out the coordinates, and we simply fired. I don't know when we were told to stop. I can't, but I know I know our troops fired like they really pounded this point.
Who had re-established the communications?
I haven't a clue. It was, I never even managed to get through this.
But you hadn't been sent out?
I hadn't been sent out, no. In fact, we stayed with this, where we were, all that morning. Fantastic morning. There was the most tremendous air battle. The Stukas came over, the first we'd ever seen, and which I was quite intrigued to find that German aeroplanes did have big black crosses on. My stories, you know, Captain Albert Ball and McCudden and Co. All of a sudden, there were these damn things with big black, and it was us. They bombed behind us, but their main attack was on the harbour, which, of course, I sorted out later. Their blitzkrieg tactics, they'd rather got them round the necks. What they should have done, they should have bombed in front, tanks through, then infantry. But they were bombing around the harbour. There were hurricanes, there was an airfield there, and the hurricanes got, and there were Stukas diving, there were Messerschmitt, the twin engine 110s. I loved it. I was sitting in the trench. Didn't matter who was getting shot. And of course, remember one chap bailing out and everybody firing at him. Everybody. And the wind blew him. Understand, he went clean over the wire. But I can distinctly remember seeing this fellow in this parachute drifting in the midst of all this mayhem. And of course, our guns were firing. Eventually, we did re-establish contact.
Did you hit him, by the way, then?
No, nobody.
It was a German.
They had different coloured parachutes to us. But it was, as I say, this was our first experience of the dreaded Stukas. As I say, the nearest they got was a few hundred yards behind us.
So it wasn't too bad?
So it wasn't too bad. It was what always impressed me with all these things was a tremendous noise. Of course, you've got guns firing and bombs exploding, and as I say, but it was all, you know, quite, it was quite a boring.